there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
But oh, yeah.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia.
That's the great Dar Williams singing with the magnificent Pete Seeger and the brilliant David Burns, who wrote the lyrics to that song from the Grammy-winning album Tomorrow's Children. That's the Solartopia song. This is the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Sluggo Wasserman. Back with you for another hour. We got one guest with us tonight, a really brilliant, very unique and special writer, reviewer, activist, and good buddy of mine for a long, long time, Ed Rampell. Ed, you with us?
Aloha, Harvey, and thank you for that very generous introduction.
Well, if you're going to say aloha, you got to call me Sluggo, man.
You know that my latest book is going to drop in April. It's the third edition, speaking of aloha, it's the third edition of the book I co-authored called The Hawaii Movie and Television Book. And the first two editions completely sold out, so the Honolulu publisher is releasing a third edition in April.
Well, to use a Hawaiian phrase, mazel tov.
I thought you were going to say noka oi or noka oi vei.
My favorite phrase in Hawaiian actually is ua mau ka ia. Oka aina I kapono, which means the life of the land.
The life of the land is perpetuated in righteousness.
There you go. You got it, brother. Good for you.
Yeah.
From West Covina, California, you're pretty knowledgeable in the ways of the Hawaiian people. So listen, there's a lot to talk about with you. I want to start, though, today. We've had some good news for a change. It is, unfortunately, the week, the 49th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island. 49 years ago, radiation was pouring into the atmosphere from the disaster at Three Mile Island. Of course, the owners of the nuke were denying that there was any problem, but of course there was a problem. And 49 years later, we're shutting down the nuclear power industry. So the good news is this. In California, Pacific Gas and Electric has announced that they have withdrawn their application for a renewed license at Diablo Canyon, which means that without a doubt now, the two reactors at Diablo Canyon will shut in 2024 and 2025. So there is no renewed license at Diablo Canyon at all, and that's the good news. The challenge there is that we need to work hard to shut those two reactors earlier. And I know, Ed, as a fellow Californian, you're going to be out on the picket lines with me. I may introduce you to the San Luis Obispo County Jail, where I spent three lovely nights back in 1984, before you were born. But we are going to really work hard now. We're going to work really hard now to shut these two reactors at Diablo Canyon before 2024 and 25, but we are now assured that those two nuclear power plants will not operate beyond 2024 and 2025 because PG&E has withdrawn their license extension. The other good news, and this is pretty amazing actually, is that FirstEnergy of Akron, Ohio, has withdrawn. Well, they've announced that they're going to shut There are four reactors, two in Ohio and two in Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh. And now this is, of course, blackmail on their part. They're trying to get the idiot fascist moron in the White House, I won't say his name, to give them big money to continue to operate these four reactors. But they have announced publicly that they intend to shut them. And, you know, as I say, they're begging the blonde idiot in the White House to give them billions of dollars to keep operating. So but the good news is that they've said the two reactors are at Beaver Valley outside of Pittsburgh. Those are the two in Pennsylvania. And then the two in Ohio, one is at Perry, east of Cleveland, and one is at Davis Bessey near Toledo. So this is four reactors they say are going to shut within 2 years. And again, they're begging First Energy is begging the White House for tons and tons of money. Hopefully they won't get it. But we'll see about that. So this is a good day for shutting nuclear power plants. And it's a good day to have Ed Rampell on my radio show. Ed, give us a little background of who you are and what you do.
Well, Fred Friendly, who was the president of CBS News and the producer for Edward R. Murrow, told me that I was the only journalist in America named after Edward R. Murrow. And my dad named me after Mr. Murrow because of his TV exposés of Senator Joseph McCarthy. And so that's the kind of background I come from. And I grew up on the New York left. And then I majored in cinema in Hunter College in Manhattan. And I was all set and ready to become the Sergei Eisenstein of the American Revolution. But then the revolution experienced technical difficulties and never ascended. So in the 1970s, I did what I thought was the most logical thing. I said, well, if I'm not going to find my workers' paradise here, I'll go find paradise somewhere else. So I went to live in the South Pacific and Micronesia and Hawaii for over 20 years.
Oh, my God. And, why did you come back?
That's a very good question. While I was there, I did a lot of reporting for Radio Australia, Radio New Zealand, even for ABC News' 2020 about the nuclear-free and independent Pacific movement. And then when I moved to Hawaii on the Hawaiian sovereignty native rights movement. And I did a lot of reporting on the struggle the anti-nuclear struggle in the Pacific Islands. And the reason why I came to L.A. Was in 1999, I moved from Hawaii to L.A. Simply because there were a lot more opportunities for writers in L.A. The Pacific always gave me a lot of great inspiration. But, you know, there are very limited outlets and markets for one's writing. So I moved to L.A. in 1999, and I've been putting that film school education to use, as my old professor, Joel Zucker, will be happy to know. Writing movie history books, including Progressive Hollywood, A People's Film History of the United States. And then...
Ed, you wrote a book called A People's Film History of the United States?
Absolutely.
Wow, that's fantastic. How can people get this book?
You know, it completely sold out. You might be able to get some copies at Amazon.com. And Greg Palast wrote the foreword to the book, by the way.
Cool. I just had lunch with Greg yesterday. So I have been reading your movie reviews. They're at the Progressive Magazine, at L.A. Progressive, at Progressive Hollywood, all over the place. You're a brilliant and prolific reviewer. You've also written for that very serious academic publisher, Hustler. But what is at the top of your mind right now that you want to talk about most to my listeners at Progressive Radio Network?
Well, in terms of cinema?
Anything you want.
Well, since we were talking about movies, let's talk about that, and then we'll move to the big project we're working on regarding Dr. King.
Actually, you know what, Ed? Let's do that in reverse, because once you get talking movies, we're never going to stop. You know, and I know that's going to happen. So you and I are co-conspiring on a major event this coming July 28th. It is the 50th anniversary of the passing of Dr. King. We still really don't know who killed him, but we know that his spirit lives on. Tell us about this event and why people should be focused on it.
Well, this is going to be a live stage commemoration with actors, activists, reenacting great historical figures. Gerald Rivers is scheduled to portray Dr. King. And we have a very special portion of the show lined up. The great Ed Asner is going to portray the abolitionist named Thaddeus Stevens. And Thaddeus Stevens was a radical Republican, not the kind we have today, that might be
a Lincoln
extremist Republican. But he was an abolitionist in the House of Representatives who proposed not only what was called Negro suffrage, but also sweeping land redistribution away from the plantation owners and to turn it over to the ex-slaves. And he was such a great voice for freedom and abolitionism that D.W. Griffith mercilessly mocked him in the 1915 racist epic, The Birth of a Nation. Although Tommy Lee Jones portrayed Thaddeus Stevens in Steven Spielberg's Lincoln in a much more accurate and favorable light. But Ed is going to...
Before we jump away, you being a movie guy, I want to tell you that at Teaching History, I showed the last 20 minutes of Lincoln to at least 50 classes. And so I saw Tommy Lee's portrayal of Thaddeus Stevens about 50 times, and he was one of very, 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 very few white men of that era who was in love with and lived with a black woman. And I thought that the portrayal of Thaddeus Stevens in the movie Lincoln, which I think is one of the great movies of all American historiography, if you set up a category of movies based on American history, that is, in my world, it's definitely in the top five. It is a great, great movie. Daniel Day-Lewis's portrayal of Lincoln was uncanny, and I thought Tommy Lee Jones was also spectacular, playing Thaddeus Stevens, who was one of the great historical figures in all of our national story. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. And I'm sure you've seen Lincoln. What do you think?
Yeah, it's an important movie about history. There's no doubt about it, and not the least of it, although it's called Lincoln, not the least of it is that it rehabilitates and restores the image and reputation of this great congressman, Thaddeus Stevens. And speaking about interracial love and stuff, we also have another interesting reenactor in our July 28th show, which is scheduled to take place in Will Geer's Theatricum Botanicum on the afternoon of July 28th. That's in Topanga Canyon, north of Malibu. We are going to have a direct descendant of the very first black first lady of the United States, about 200 years before Michelle Obama. And I am, of course, talking about Thomas Jefferson's common law wife, Sally Hemings. And a direct descendant of Sally and Thomas Jefferson is going to portray her great-great, many times removed grandmother, Sally Hemings. This reenactor's name is Evelia Jones, and she is going to read an adaptation of Sally's son's memoir. Now, getting back to Ed Asner,
this will be the son. This will be the son, the mixed race son of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings.
That's exactly right. His memory of Tom, of growing up at Monticello, his memory of his mother, what happened to her after Jefferson died, and it's his interview as a free man living in Ohio.
Right.
His name was
Thomas Woodson.
And it was to a Ohio publication that he made these revelations. And James Earl Jones portrayed him, actually, in a movie. And then I think the movie flashes back to Sally and Tom. This was a very interesting interracial love story. And so this is going to be part of the Martin Luther King commemoration. But Ed Asner, who, as you may know, Ed Asner portrayed President Roosevelt in a one-man show about FDR.
Franklin Roosevelt,
now,
I saw it.
Wasn't it great?
Oh, magnificent. I saw it with my daughter, who's in the car with me, Shoshi, and we saw it in Cleveland, and we actually had the amazing experience of getting Dennis Kucinich into the theater free because we had an extra ticket. So all three of us saw it in Cleveland, and Ed Asner was 2 hours on stage, for God's sakes, portraying Franklin Roosevelt. He was unbelievable, just fantastic.
Yes, he is amazing. You know, he's won so many Emmys, and he's been such a champion of human rights as well. But now he's going to portray one of our more dubious presidents in our Martin Luther King show. He's going to portray Harry S. Truman. Now, you know, President Truman was nicknamed Give 'Em Hell Harry, but we're going to have a vignette where Give 'Em Hell Harry was given hell by Paul Robeson. And K.B. Solomon, the great singer, enactor and reenactor of Paul Robeson, is going to depict, along with Ed Asner, the real-life scene in the White House when Paul Robeson had a heated confrontation with Harry because President Truman refused to back an anti-lynching law after World War II. And it got so angry that the Secret Service agents revealed their pistols.
Yeah, and let's recall,
and that is going to be part of our show.
That's fantastic. And let's recall that at this time of history, the Democratic Party was still dominated by racist white Southerners tracing their lineage to Andrew Jackson, the worst racist white Southerner of all. And Harry Truman of Missouri was of that mode. And the Southerners in the Democratic Party was so powerful that even Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt were unable to get a lynch law through Congress, and this proceeded, continued with Harry Truman.
So we're still enlisting notables to be reenactors. A comedian named Trey Crowder, whose nickname is the Liberal Redneck. He was on a Bill Maher show for the second time as a guest about a month ago. Trey is going to be one of our reenactors. And then this really great historian and activist that you might have heard of is going to portray the presidential candidate who ran for the White House from a prison cell. Eugene V. Debs is going to be portrayed by this guy you might have heard of named Harvey Wasserman.
Yes, now I do have, thank you, and I am honored to be able to do that. There is one drawback, which is that, although actually it's a plus for me, which is that Gene Debs was bald and I am not. So I'm going to have to wear a derby hat to conceal my hair, but I'm honored to be able to do Gene Debs. It's something I've dreamed about, portraying Gene Debs on stage all my life. So this is going to be a great opportunity, and I thank you, Ed Rampell, for doing this. We're talking with Ed Rampell, the great film reviewer, critic, writer, journalist, book publisher. He's talking to us from West Covina, California. If you haven't noticed, I'm in the back of a car driving through Los Angeles with my daughters in the front seat. But that's the glories of radio and of PRN. You're listening to the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show on Progressive Radio Network. Our crew in New York is doing their usual stellar job, and we will be having this event in Topanga Canyon. I hope, for God's sake, Ed, that we can film it and make it available to the general public.
Well, you know, when we did our 70th anniversary of the Hollywood Blacklist commemoration, we had at least two film crews shoot it. Filmmakers from France flew over to, among other things, shoot it at the Writers Guild Theater in Beverly Hills on October 27th. But it was also filmed by C-SPAN. And C-SPAN actually broadcast our 70th anniversary commemoration of the Hollywood Blacklist, and we are hoping that C-SPAN, especially the History Channel of C-SPAN, will want to also cover our Dr. King historic commemoration and reenactments.
Well, let's segue in. I want to talk with you about the Hollywood Blacklist. Let's talk about the event first. Where can people go to see that? It was a magnificent event. I was there from start to finish. Absolutely spectacular. Where can people go see it, and then you can tell us all about it?
Well, thank you, Harvey. Yes, it was over 4 hours long, and if people want to see it, they can. This is a very long link. You could go to C-SPAN's website, cspan.org, and I guess that you could Google Hollywood Blacklist. But if you want me to, I could read this
I'll post it at the. You can send it to me. Do you have a website of your own, Ed Rampell?
Well, you can read a lot about me and a lot of my stuff at some of the websites I write for, such as HollywoodProgressive.com, People's World, etc., the Progressive Magazine. I myself don't actually have...
Okay, so I will post. You will email me the link to the video of the wonderful Blacklist event that you put on, and I'll post it in the blurb for this show. So it'll be up at PRN, and people can go to PRN on the Solartopia slot there and find the link to this amazing show. So tell us, Ed Rampell, about the event and about the Blacklist. Tell us about the Blacklist and what was involved, because we are expecting one soon, again, from the fascist in the White House.
What happened was that on October 27th, 1947, the very first member of what came to be known as the Hollywood Ten was called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Now, this is in the House of Representatives. It's not to be confused with Joe McCarthy's Senate subcommittee, which was separate but did similar things, although people often conflate McCarthy and HUAC. McCarthy focused on people who were in the U.S. government, the U.S. Army, although he did call artists such as Howard Fast, who wrote the novel that broke the Hollywood blacklist, Spartacus. He called Langston Hughes. Do you remember the folk singer Millard Lampel?
I remember Millard Fillmore.
This is a folk singer who is very prominent. I believe, if memory serves correctly, that Mr. Lampel, whom I wonder if I'm actually related to this guy, because Lampel, they're very unusual names.
Your ancestors probably had the same clerk at Ellis Island, and he did Lampel. It's probably
That's kind of what I'm thinking. And also, there are certain letters that are interchanged promiscuously from language to language, and L and R is very interchangeable in the Polynesian dialects. In Hawaii, La is the sun. In Tahiti, Ra is the sun. But getting back to the Hollywood blacklist, so John Howard Lawson had been the first president of the Writers Guild of America, what is now the Writers Guild of America. It was called something else in the 30s. And Lawson wrote great anti-fascist movies, including Blockade, which Jane Fonda writes about in her autobiography, because her father, Henry Fonda, starred in Blockade with Madeline Carroll, and it was the first Hollywood movie I'm not talking about documentaries, I'm talking about feature films, on the Spanish Civil War. There was only one problem. They couldn't say Spain in the entire movie. But Lawson wrote that movie, which had a really rock'em sock'em ending, straight out of Sergei Eisenstein, the Soviet director's movie Potemkin. It's very similar ending. And he went on to do these anti-Nazi Humphrey Bogart movies, Action in the North Atlantic, Sahara. So Lawson testified on October 27th, 1947, he was reputedly the leader of the Hollywood branch of the Communist Party USA. And so to honor Lawson and the Hollywood 10 and all the people who were victimized by the Hollywood blacklist, we held the 70th commemoration on the exact day that Lawson testified, and we held it in the theater of the guild that he helped to found and was the first president of, the Writers Guild Theater in Beverly Hills. And so the commemoration included a number of family members of the people who were persecuted by the House Un-American Activities Committee, speaking and reenacting their relatives, like Ellen Geer, who is the artistic director of Will Geer's Theatricum Botanicum, where we're going to have our Dr. King event. She read the HUAC testimony of her father, Will Geer. Now, our readers may remember Will Geer from The Waltons, which was a very popular, beloved TV series in the 70s. And Will Geer was blacklisted from movies. He had been in a lot of Westerns, and he was blacklisted because he refused to be an informer. And Ellen read his testimony. Will, by the way, went on to be in that great left-wing classic called Salt of the Earth. He played the evil sheriff in it, who actually isn't that evil, but he's a bad guy. What happened was that if you were called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee, you were asked whether or not you were a member of the Communist Party. But they wouldn't stop there. If you admitted that, then they would proceed to ask you about many other people. So it wasn't just a question of talking about your own political history. It was a question of informing on other people and placing them at risk. So Will Geer and John Howard Lawson refused to do that. Will Geer was banished from the movies for many years, so he went on to create his own theater, that Will Geer's Theatrical Botanica, that amphitheater.
All right, so I want to jump in on this. As a historian, I love unintended consequences. So are you saying, in a backhanded way, that because of the blacklist and because Will Geer couldn't get movie work, he founded this magnificent theater that we're going to have this Dr. King commemoration at?
That's what's called poetic justice. Yeah, that is correct. And by the way, the Will Geer's Theatrical Botanicum is a great theater company. I've been going for many summers. It's always a highlight for me. They do really, really great plays. Last summer, they did a wonderful production of George Orwell's Animal Farm. And they do a combination of Shakespeare classics, some new plays, meaning sometimes plays specifically written for the theatricum, and also other playwrights' works. This summer, right after our 2 o'clock performance, that night on July 28th, is going to be a play called Haiti, about the Haitian Revolution, Toussaint Louverture, Dessalines, etc. So they do really edgy, really great work, as well as these wonderful Shakespearean classics. So getting back to the blacklist, people had a choice. If you became an informer and gave not only purged yourself, but gave the names of others, you were generally allowed to continue to work in the movies. If you didn't cooperate, you would be banished from Hollywood, which basically had a monopoly on feature filmmaking. And about 300 people, actors, directors, writers, producers, were blacklisted. The Hollywood 10, they all went to prison. They served prison time. They had to pay a fine for contempt of Congress. And Dalton Trumbo, one of the blacklisted screenwriters in the Hollywood 10, Dalton Trumbo, said, yes, it was true. I did have contempt for Congress. And it was a very harrowing time. The guy who wrote The Thin Man, Dashiell Hammett, he went to prison. It was a very, very scary time. And what we tried
Do you think the blacklist, given the fascist in the White House, do you think the blacklist could come back?
Absolutely. I think that although we obviously don't live under fascism now, because if they did, you know, we couldn't do this radio show and live to tell the story. But it's true that the current regime does have a very authoritarian, autocratic streak. Trump has one of the worst personality flaws, which is don't you hate the people who can dish it out, but they can't take it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and this guy just can't stand Alec Baldwin. He just can't stand criticism. You know, Comedy Central had this wonderful show with this guy named Anthony. His last name is hard for me to pronounce. It's something like Adaminuak. I'm sorry, I'm butchering his last name. Maybe it's an Armenian last name. I'm not sure, but it's hard for me to pronounce. But nevertheless, he was even better than Alec Baldwin. It was a whole half-hour weekly show mocking Trump. I also saw him at Politicon in Pasadena do an hour stand-up show as Trump. And this guy has this really left-wing intellectual understanding and critique of Trump. It's very sophisticated. His show has not been seen on Comedy Central for about 3 months now or more. And I'm kind of wondering, like, what happened to this guy? Was he put on the chopping block? I definitely think that the First Amendment is at risk now. I definitely think that we have got to resist in order to save our constitutional rights. And so I do think, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at what's going on at college campuses nowadays, there's all this, like, right-wing attempt to co-opt the free speech movement. And what they're not defending, what people like Ann Helter Skelter Coulter, what they never talk about when they talk about freedom of speech on contemporary college campuses is how the I think it's called the BDSM movement is being restricted, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement against Israeli militarism and occupation in Gaza and the West Bank and so on. People who support that, not just students but professors, are harassed. They're driven off campus. So Norman Finkelstein, I heard today on KPFK, on Mitch Cesaris' show, that he was driven out of academia like 11 years ago. I do think that freedom of speech is something we can't take for granted. And, you know, when the Dixie Chicks got into a lot of trouble, they were honored by the L.A. branch of the Civil Liberties Union, American Civil Liberties Union. So when they arrived, I asked them, what's your favorite of the Ten Amendments? And Natalie Maines said, you know, the first one, you know, that right to bear big mouths.
I like that. I like that. That's great. We're talking with Ed Rampell, a wonderful, extremely well-known, well-circulated film critic and political activist, organized a magnificent show on the Blacklist in Beverly Hills, and is a co-organizer with me, actually the lead organizer of the an upcoming event where we're going to honor Dr. Martin Luther King 50 years after somebody shot him. Someday we'll find out who it was. Ed, we're going to continue to talk about Dr. King, but I wanted you to talk now about you recently reviewed a movie called about Karl Marx and Frederick Engels. There's a first for you. In college I was a Marxist, but I was a Groucho Marxist. And in fact, I've been staying with Lila Garrett, the great host at KPFK, who knew Groucho Marx very well, actually. None of us ever met Karl Marx. Tell us about this film about Karl Marx. First of all,
I would say to anybody who wants to know about the historical details, the biographical background of Marx during the 1840s, as well as about his philosophy, you should definitely see this movie, The Young Karl Marx. This Haitian film director and screenwriter, Raoul Peck, did this incredible job, which as a historian, Harvey, you would really appreciate. How many history books have you written? 20?
Well, I've written 20 books. They're not all histories, but, I have no history of my own history writing. But, yes, I've always been interested. Karl Marx, to me, has always been kind of this black box. I mean, we know about his writings, but we don't know about him. And this film,
this movie fills in the blanks. This is the life of Marx as a young man, and it shows his day-to-day life, but it also shows his political and philosophical maturing, how Frederick Engels and Marx complemented one another. And it's a very entertaining movie, and it's also a romance. And this movie is so extraordinary in so many ways. I mean, Raoul Peck did this great research where he would read from these letters by people who were at certain meetings, eyewitnesses of meetings with Karl Marx, and then he puts it into the script. It's quite amazing what he did, but it's also beautiful because it shows the friendship between Freddie and Chucky, Frederick Engels and Karl Marx. But it also shows...
Karl Marx was called Chucky?
No, I'm just being facetious here. But he's like, okay. You know, he's like a normal guy, and they get drunk together and all this. He's a human being. He's a very human person. But you not only see this great friendship, true friendship, but you also see this great marriage between Karl and Jenny Marx. Jenny was an aristocrat. She was a baroness, and she gave it all up out of love for Marx, who was not only a Jew, but he was middle class. So in terms of the German pecking order of ethnicity and class, he was quote-unquote beneath her. But you see they have this great romance, very erotic, very beautiful. It's the same actress who stars opposite Daniel Day-Lewis in The Phantom Thread. And then you see the romance between Frederick Engels and Mary Burns. And Mary Burns, now, they had the reverse situation. Frederick Engels was actually born into the bourgeoisie. His father was a factory owner. Mary was one of those factory workers who, she was Irish. Then she relocated to, I believe, Manchester, where she worked in the Engels factory, according to the movie. And so Freddie falls in love with Mary, who is this proletarian Irish woman, and it's like true love. And if you listen to the movie closely, the one who says the most radical, revolutionary dialogue is arguably Mary. You have to listen closely. She says something that shocks Jenny so much that Jenny does like a double take. You know, it was a good thing she wasn't drinking something. She would have spit out her wine or whatever. So listen closely to Mary's dialogue. And it's such a beautiful romances. And you see these four comrades who are all united around the cause of uplifting the human race. And then the movie is told in pretty conventional narrative filmmaking techniques. It's pretty standard biopic. But at the end, Raoul Peck does something. He takes a page from the great Soviet directors like Sergei Eisenstein. And what Raoul Peck does is, and it's hard to believe this, but it's very quick. You have to watch closely. It's only a minute or two. He has this montage of rapid cuts where he visualizes the Communist Manifesto. The movie leads up to Karl and Frederick in 1848, writing the Communist Manifesto just as revolution sweeps Europe in 1848. But he visually shows in cinematic language in a very beautiful way. He, meaning Peck, shows graphically the Communist Manifesto. It's just like amazing. And then the film ends during the credits. Watch it closely. There's another montage with Nelson Mandela and Che Guevara, et cetera, sort of updating it to a more contemporary time, so to speak. And so this May 5th is Karl Marx's 200th birthday. I'm planning to have a screening. This hasn't been worked out, the details yet. But on the evening of May 5th, which is a Saturday, at the Strategy Center in Los Angeles, we are going to screen and discuss the young Karl Marx. So people in L.A. will get a chance to see it. And then with at the L.A. Worker Center, where I had a 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution film series, we're discussing doing another film series for this year on Marxist movies at the L.A. Worker Center, also known as the Red House.
So are you going to show Duck Soup or Night at the Opera?
You know that Duck Soup is a very political film.
Yeah, you should show it. Absolutely.
It's a wonderful satire. The screenwriters were great satirists, as were the Marx Brothers. A Night at the Opera, of course, spoofed culture. But Duck Soup very, very specifically makes fun of war. It makes fun of government.
Right.
Do you remember there's one scene at the end, which some people could interpret as being racially insensitive, but
yeah.
The Marx Brothers at the end are singing, "You got guns, I got guns, all of God's chillins got guns." I think it's their best movie, Duck Soup.
Well, you ought to consider showing it. We're talking with Ed Rampell, organizer, writer, reviewer, of great stuff. And this movie, Young Karl Marx, you have not seen the Death of Stalin, which I don't know about.
I think I'm going to go see it Saturday. I'm going to try and go see it. It's a satire by the creator of the great HBO series called Veep, where Julia Louis-Dreyfus plays the U.S. vice president. His name is something like Iannucci. It's a little hard for me to pronounce. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
But and he wrote The Death of Stalin. So I am very interested to see that. I really hate Stalin. Raoul Peck said to me, the first people Stalin would have killed if they were alive was Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, Jenny
right.
Marx, and Mary Burns. They were the first.
Just like the first guy that all the fundamentalist Christians would kill would be Jesus. So there you go.
Good analogy.
Ed Rampell, as a Hollywood guy living here in L.A., I want your take now on what's happened with the Oscars and with the film industry in general in terms of politics in the age of Trump. Where do we stand with our film industry with this guy in the White House and with the coming of the Chinese, who have become more and more influential in the making of films?
Well, that's a very a deep question. I've been interviewed for a new upcoming French documentary called Trumpzilla, which is about Trump in Hollywood. And I think that the people who are at the forefront now of the cultural resistance are the comedians, the satirists, the obvious ones are Alec Baldwin, Saturday Night Live, Samantha Bee. Stephen Colbert is just astonishing. Seth Meyers, but also here in L.A., there's a group. I went to see them perform last night at the Irvine Improv called Minority Reports, which are all quote-unquote ethnic comedians from like Mona Sheikh of Pakistan, Tehran, who is half Persian, half black, half African-American. And they're all like Afghani, India ancestry, a lot of gender equality in Minority Reports. So I think that, it's interesting. I think that we've had two great movies so far that, you know, I'm a big one for trying to interpret movies. And I apply Sigmund Freud's interpretation of dreams, the technique that he laid out in that, and also some of Carl Gustav Jung's dream analysis. And I apply it to the movies. And we've had two movies that I think really are about Trump, although, of course, he's never mentioned in them. And one was a great movie by Warren Beatty called, I believe it was called Rules Don't Apply, where he plays a Meshuggah billionaire, John Paul Getty. And this was clearly, this was just as Trump, it was before he was inaugurated, but after he won is when it came out. And this is clearly an image of Trump, this this demented billionaire. And then we saw another crazy billionaire depicted a year later, came out in December with a lot of hoopla, called All the Money in the World. And the guy from A Sound of Music portrays J. Paul Getty as this very greedy, crazy billionaire. And this is another portrait, you know, these eccentric bourgeoisie. Why are the movies coming out with these figures now? So I think that those movies are unconscious, veiled criticism of Trump, who is clearly a maniac. So people, when they see movies, they should, like, read between the lines. We're also having, you know, really good documentaries. Like, you know that there's an expression called seeing red. Well, there's a really excellent documentary called Seeing All Red, and it's about Gloria Allred. About her crusade on behalf of women's rights for so many decades. And, you know, she is the champion now. She doesn't represent Stormy Daniels or Karen McDougal, but she represents the third woman who has who is publicly taking Trump on, Summer Zervos, who was contestant on The Apprentice, who claims that Donald Trump sexually harassed her. And Gloria is representing her in a libel suit against Trump, which is hysterical because Trump has been trumpeting this idea of expanding libel laws
in order to preserve
the First Amendment. But he's the one having a defamation lawsuit against him. So there are good documentaries out.
I heard a discussion the other day about the growing influence of China and the China market on the films that Hollywood is making. Do you have anything to say about that? It's said disturbingly that because the Chinese are so culturally conservative, that it's actually having a chilling effect on some of the movies being made by the major studios.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I did see one really god-awful movie that was the most expensive movie, feature film, I believe, ever made by the People's Republic of China. And it's called The Great Wall. And it was just an awful, awful movie. It was a propaganda film. There was a message in there about war and China and this and that. And that wasn't really, that wasn't really the stuff that was very disturbing. It was just this nonstop special effects violence, extremely repetitive. And we had really good actors, American actors, with Chinese actors. We had Willem Dafoe, who, he was just not Oscar nominated, obviously not for this movie. He's in The Great Wall completely.
And Matt Damon.
Yes, and I was going to say Matt Damon. And it's just a god-awful movie. They didn't even film it at the Great Wall of China, for God's sake. Although it's depicted throughout the whole film, but it's like a set, or, you know, it's a fabrication or whatever, but they didn't go to the Great Wall. So it's just like a spectacle in the worst sense of the term. It makes Cecil B. DeMille look like Ingmar Bergman.
Well, there you go. Yeah, so I hope the Chinese aren't going to be quashing creativity here in Hollywood. I mean, that would be really a drag. It wouldn't be a drag, actually. They wouldn't allow drag to. Uh-oh, we're done. Ed Rappel, thank you so much. Thank you for New York. We'll see you next week. You were great.
Thank you, Harvey. See everybody July 28th at Will Gear Theatrical and Botanica in 2 p.m.
You got it, buddy.
Soletopia, Soletopia. Soletopia, don't you know we're gonna have a Soletopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna